Okay, yeah. So, welcome back again, everyone. So we're going to continue where we left off yesterday. And, okay. It's very nice. we're going to carry on. And yesterday we finished having a look at the Bhayabhairava Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 4. And the next sutta on our list is called the Upakilesa Sutta. And as the sutta you're seeing here is number 128 of the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length sayings of the Buddha. And it kind of continues where we left off yesterday. Yesterday we were looking at how the Buddha was dealing with various kinds of problems in his meditation. Yeah, he was going into the jungle and he was experiencing all kinds of things, defilements that he was looking into, and he kind of overcoming that by kind of facing his fear and dread, and in that way understanding his own mind and overcoming these problems. And today we're going to continue with this idea of looking at the defilements of the mind, the things that block progress in meditation. Yeah, this is kind of what this is about, the main part of the sutta, and it still continues with the life of the Buddha, and in other words, how the Buddha dealt with these things. But this particular sutta is a very rich sutta. The content is very large and very broad, so we're going to look at all of these little details of how the path works and all kind of issues that come up in this marvelous, amazing, wonderful sutta. Every sutta is wonderful and marvelous, but this one is really more wonderful and marvelous. No, you can't really say that. They're all wonderful and marvelous. So, upakilesa, the word upakilesa, as I mentioned before, is related to the word kilesa. In the suttas, you find this word kilesa in many versions of it. You find upakilesa, you find sankilesa, and you find kilesa. And they mean roughly the same thing. It refers to defilements of the mind, corruptions of the mind, blemishes of the mind, problems of the mind. Yeah, things that get in the way of the progress of developing and cultivating the mind in peace, tranquility, metta, compassion, all of these things that we're trying to develop. And the word upakilesa specifically refers to the refined defilements of the mind. Yeah, the more coarser defilements, they are often just called greed or ill will. Yeah, but these are like the refined defilements. And the word upakilesa is used in the suttas, for example, to describe the five hindrances. The five hindrances are like the very last thing that you need to overcome to achieve samadhi. So the five hindrances really are about refined defilements of the mind. They're called upakilesa, at least one place in the suttas. Often we think of the five hindrances as a very broad category, including all the defilements. But actually, if you look at the gradual training, the coarse defilements of the mind, they are overcome by a virtue, by living well, by speaking in the right way, acting in the right way. That's how the coarse defilements are overcome. And then the next stage is sense restraint. Sense restraint is how to overcome the coarse defilements of ill will and greed and these kind of things. Then there is clear awareness. Yeah, this is the sampajanya, another stage on the path. And only when all of those things are done, only then do you overcome the five hindrances. So they are like the refined problems of the mind coming towards the very end of the path. And they are overcome basically through meditation practice, while you're watching the breath. Yeah, once mindfulness has been established, then you watch the breath. You do the Satipatthana practice. That is where these last defilements, the Nivarana, the five hindrances, the Upakilesa, where they are overcome. And this is very clear. We shall see this in the Sutta. It becomes very clear here. The word upakilesa is also used elsewhere. It is used in the Vatupama Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 7. Vatupa means the simile of the cloth. You know that sutta, the simile of the cloth? Yeah, you know, yeah, right. It's a beautiful sutta found there in how if you're going to dye cloth. It has to be pure, first of all. You have to get rid of all the defilements of the cloth. If the cloth is not clean and nice, it will not take the dye. It will not dye very nicely. In the same way, the mind has to be pure and bright in order for insight to work properly. And in that sutta, you have a large number of problems of the mind that are listed, all kind of things, like in addition to the normal list, like you know, being arrogant and having a domineering attitude and all of these kind of things. I hope I'm not too arrogant myself, because I heard the other day maybe I'm a bit arrogant. I apologize if that's the case, but I try, I promise, I really try to overcome these defilements. All of these things are also kind of considered refined defilements of the mind, yeah? All of these things. So this is kind of how the word upakilesa is used in the suttas, just to give you a little bit of background for that. The word kilesa, without the upa in front, usually is used just to mean loba, dosa, moha, yeah? Raga, dosa, moha. These are the three root defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion. I don't think greed, hatred, and delusion is a very good translation, to be honest with you, because loba and raga just means desire in a very general sense. Dosa means ill will. It doesn't mean hate is a very strong word, right? If you hate someone, it's like it's a very powerful emotion. It doesn't just mean that. It means any kind of ill will. And moha means when your mind is confused or you don't know what's going on. Delusion, okay, maybe a bit too profound, but it's okay. That's where kilesa is used. And then sankilesa is used often when the word is compounded with other words. Then you find the word sankilesa. So the sang in front doesn't change the meaning all that much. This sutta then is part of a number of suttas that actually deal with the same kind of set of ideas, if you like, or they deal with the same incident, I should say. And this whole sutta is based around the incident called the incident at Kosambi. This sutta is spoken at Kosambi. Have you heard about Kosambi before? Yeah, Kosambi. Yeah, okay. Kosambi, one of the great cities in ancient India. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the argument at Kosambi, precisely. This is what this is going to be about, actually, in a second. But Kosambi was also one of the five great cities of ancient India. You had Rajagaha, Savati. You had Kosambi, Varanasi, and then you had Champa, I think, was the last one of these five great cities in ancient India. Six great cities. What am I saying now? Kosambi? Okay, anyway, something like that. Close enough. If you want to check it out, look at the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, Digha Nikaya 16. That's where the great cities of ancient India are talked about, but Kosambi is one of them. I think Vesali may have been one of them as well, actually. So there's a number of suttas that kind of revolve around this idea. And for example, in the Vinaya Pitaka, which is what I have translated myself, in that Vinaya Pitaka, this incident is also talked about, but it gives a broader view of what is happening. So I'm going to bring in some of the ideas from the Vinaya Pitaka as well. Some of the verses that are found in the sutta, very beautiful verses. Yeah, we'll look at those in a second. The one about hatred is never overcome by hatred. Hatred is overcome by love. This is an eternal law. Yeah, this comes in this particular sutta. Also found in the Vinaya. Also found in the Dhammapada. Right. So it is found kind of. You can really know it is a core verse. It is found so broadly across the suttas, and the famous story of the Parileyaka forest. You know the story of the Parileyaka forest? You know, I'm sure you do when I tell you the story. It's the famous story of the monkey that gives the honey to the Buddha. You know that story? There's a famous story, the monkey gives the honey to the Buddha. The elephant is the upatak of the Buddha. Buddha is living in the Parileyaka forest. The monkey gives the honey to the Buddha, right? And he's hanging on this branch, and he gets so happy when he gives the honey to the Buddha that he falls off the branch, falls out of the tree, crashes to the ground, and gets reborn straight into the heavenly realm. It's a cute story, isn't it? Can you just imagine this monkey getting so excited for doing such an act of generosity towards the Buddha? And that's where that story comes from, and That story varies a little bit because, again, it exists in many places. It's part of the Jataka or Dhammapada Atthakatha, I'm not sure. And it's also part of the Vinaya. And there are various versions of that story. All of these things come together, yeah, in one kind of large group of suttas coming together. They're all relating to each other in a sense. So this is what we're going to have a look at. So let's just start, and then I'm going to kind of meander a bit, like we usually do, back and forth, and talk about this content. So, as usual, the sutta starts off by saying, So I have heard, at one time the Buddha was staying near Kosambi in Gosita's monastery here. So Kosambi was the largest city in the Chaiti Republic, yeah, the Chaiti country, the 16 large countries at the time of the Buddha. The north of India was divided into 16 countries. The Chaiti was one of those. These countries are enumerated in the Anguttara Nikaya. 16 elsewhere, there's only 9, I think. The number varies a little bit, but this is how the north of India was divided in those days. Kosambi was one of the capitals. And Gosita's monastery, there was probably a fellow called Gosita who had given this monastery here. Not only men gave monasteries, sometimes we think about Indian culture, and we think of it as very kind of male-dominated culture. But even in ancient India, there were also wealthy women who would give monasteries to the Sangha. And one of those famous monasteries is the Pubbarama. Pubbarama means the Eastern Monastery. And it was given by Visakha. Yeah, you all heard about Visakha, yeah, one of the Buddha's chief female lay disciples. And she was known as Visakha Migaramata. Migaramata means the mother of Migara. And Migara was her father-in-law, and she was the one who brought her father-in-law to the Dhamma. So she was a very inspiring lady, Visakha. And there's some very nice stories about her in the Vinaya and other places, and very interesting stories. But I'm not going to talk about them here. Next year, maybe. So come back next year. We'll hear about Visakha Migaramata. This is how you prepare people to come back year after year. we are experts at psychological manipulation, the Buddhist monks. All right. Okay, so now at that time, the mendicants of Kosambi were arguing, quarreling, and disputing here, continually wounding each other with barbed words. Then a mendicant went up to the Buddha, bowed, stood to one side, and told him what was happening, adding, "Please, sir, go to those mendicants out of compassion." Here we have the Sangha is arguing, this of course happens because Sangha, bhikkhus, bhikkhunis are just like ordinary people. Not everyone is maybe ordinary, some people are arahants, but of course the majority of the Sangha is always going to be just ordinary people, and so you expect to find ordinary defilements also in the Sangha, and this is what you're seeing here. And it's kind of nice to know that even at the time of the Buddha, the Sangha was not all arahants and all kind of marvelous people. There were ordinary people then, just like there are ordinary people now. Sometimes people think that at the time of the Buddha, easy to get enlightened because everyone was really kind of pure and beautiful and powerful. Not at all. Exactly the same defilements then as people have now. If you want to know about the defilements of the Sangha or even lay people in those days, you can read the Vinaya Pitaka, about the conduct of the monastics. And sometimes you probably be shocked by some of those stories in the Vinaya Pitaka. They're really over the top sometimes. Really kind of crazy stuff going on even in those days. And so people are people, yeah? And so it's not really shocking at all when you think about it. It's just people being people. And people do all kind of things. That's the nature of human beings. So it actually is to be expected. But don't make it into an excuse. to think that at the time of the Buddha, yeah, easy to practice, now difficult. No, basically, the difference isn't that great. And it is perfectly possible to practice now. They were continually wounding each other with barbed words. Yeah. And this is when you get into an argument, we can use words as weapons. Yeah. And this is, of course, something we should really avoid as Buddhists, to use words as weapons. Words can be incredibly hurtful. Sometimes a word can be more hurtful than a physical, you know, a physical kind of hurting, right? Because they go straight to the mind. It's psychologically painful. And psychological pain can often be very, very difficult to deal with. So for this reason, it's so important that we learn this idea of right speech in Buddhism. We don't hurt each other. Instead, we lift each other up. And we talk words that are gentle, kind, go to the heart, conducive to harmony. And all of these kind of things that are meaningful and useful. So words can be very, very problematic. And especially when we get into an argument, it's very easy to be led astray by these things. So this is... Mukka satehi vittudanta. You see the word mukka satehi here, over here. And mukka is the mouth, and satta or sati here is a sword, yeah? The sword of the mouth, quite literally. Yeah, so you wound each other with the sword of the mouth. Vittudanta is a kind of wounding here, I think, yeah. So, in other words, you have to be very careful how we use our now, so what is going on here? Why are the monastics arguing here? Do you know the story behind that? Anyone know the story exactly why? Yeah, okay, of course. Okay, Yin would know the story. So I apologize, Yin. I'm going to have to repeat everything you know already. So please. There's always some people in an audience like this who are very knowledgeable about the Dhamma. And that's wonderful that people are knowledgeable. I really like that. But anyway, I'm going to repeat it just for the benefit of everyone. And it's kind of interesting when you know a little bit about why these things happening here. And they are really arguing. And what is happening is that the Sangha is split into two camps. Yeah, there's one side and then there's the other side. And people are taking sides. Yeah, and this is, of course, how you end up with a split in the Sangha. You get a schism, right? This is called a Sangha Beda in the Pali. Beda means like a split in the Sangha. And this is one of the really bad ideas, is to split the Sangha. Because once you split the Sangha, the whole world gets very confused. Who is right? Who is wrong? And people lose interest in Buddhism. They go astray and they become Christians, or they become atheists, or they become believers in Thor and Odin. Have you heard about Thor and Odin? These are my old gods before I was a Buddhist. I believed in Thor and Odin. These are the Nordic gods, right? Valhalla, that's right. That's the heaven of Thor and Odin. You go to heaven and you continue drinking and fighting in heaven. That's kind of that's the Viking idea of heaven. It's kind of crazy, isn't it? And so the Sangha is getting divided because they are disputing. But what is kind of fascinating here is the thing that they are disputing about. And you would think that this is something very major, right? You think this is about kind of the meaning of Nibbana or kind of something like that. Yeah, the precise definition of the jhanas or how to practice or whatever. Something really important that actually makes the whole difference for whether Buddhism is going to survive or not. This is really, really important. So do you think it's really, really important, or what do you think? Yeah, what kind of any guesses here? Of course, not really. Human nature is not like that. Human nature is like we argue over the small things in life, right? Have you noticed that in your own life? How often you end up arguing about the small things? This is humanity for you. This is exactly how we are, and these monastics were exactly the same. And so the argument, what it is about? There was a monk. He had been to the toilet, right? Been to the bathroom. And after finishing his business in the toilet, there was a little pitcher, a little kind of, you know, jug or whatever that used for rinsing, water in the toilets. And after he had finished kind of using this water in the toilet, he left water in the pitcher. And leaving water in the pitcher is considered a no-no. You're not supposed to leave water in the pitcher. And this was what this argument was about. You left water in the pitcher. But that is not an offense. Yes, it is an offense. No, not an offense. Yes, it is an offense. No, not an offense. And then this way, the argument started. It's kind of the smallest thing you can imagine almost, right? Whether you leave water in the pitcher in the toilet or not. It doesn't matter, right? It's completely irrelevant. But this is kind of the human nature. So how do we even get to that point? And very often the reason why we get to that point is that there are previous arguments, previous things. And this is like the famous straw that breaks the famous camel's back, right? And then the camel can't take it anymore. The camel breaks down. And the kind of the two humps on the camel, they start to separate. You get a schism in the Sangha as a consequence. So this is how things happen. Yeah, this is kind of how we are often as human beings. So watch out for those things, because very often the reason why we argue in this way is because there are underlying, unresolved issues in our life. So make sure that you always resolve your issues. If you start to feel that things are getting a bit tense or going the wrong way, try to find out the cause. Try to resolve it straight away. Otherwise, it tends to build up until eventually you explode, right? And when you explode or you argue about small things, it's a very bad idea. This is often how human beings are. We don't really want to get angry. We don't want to argue. So we hold it in until we can't hold it in anymore. And then kind of we erupt like a volcano at some particular point. So this is how things go. And it's kind of interesting to know that this was kind of the background story. And there's almost a schism in the Sangha because of that. And then this monk goes to the Buddha, yeah, and he says to the Buddha, he bows down, and he says, please come out of compassion, right? This is a nice way of putting it. Anukampa down here is the word for compassion. The word anukampa is like a beautiful word. Kampa is to shake or to tremble. Tremble might be a nice word. So anu is a prefix that means something like along with. So like you tremble along with someone else. And if you really have compassion towards somebody, it's like you can feel almost like a trembling because you see the suffering in another being. Yeah? And then you want to help. You want to do something. Yeah? And this is expressed in this word, anukampa. Huh? So if you want a monk or a nun to do something, yeah, and you want to invite them to give a talk, or you want to invite them to visit someone in hospital or whatever it is, this is the right way to ask. Please come out of compassion. Yeah, because this is the motivating force for monastics usually, and especially the Buddha. Remember the Buddha, the whole reason for the Buddha's decision eventually to teach is compassion for the world, right? I didn't actually read that part of the Ariyaparyesana Sutta, the Noble Search, for the Buddha decides to teach in the world, but he decides out of compassion. He looks out with the eye of the Buddha, he looks out into the world, and he sees people who are sunk in delusion, sunk in suffering, and he knows that he has the answer. And because he knows he has the answer, compassion arises. And then he goes into the world and starts teaching the Dhamma. It's always compassion that is the motivating force for a good, for the Buddha specifically, but also really for any good monastic in teaching or helping out one way or another. That's a nice way to write. Yeah. So if you really want Ajahn Brahm to come to KL, Bobby, please say out of compassion. Please out of compassion, come to KL and see what happens. Yeah. This is, don't tell him I said that, because he might not be too happy if I give away the trade secrets. But there you are. There you are. All right. The Buddha consented with silence. This is how the Buddha usually consents by silence. All right, let's stop there. Let's do 5 minutes of meditation, and then we'll carry on in a second. Okay. So, any questions or comments, please? Okay. Take those now.
I just wonder, Buddha has immense psychic power, right?
Yeah.
And even then,
yeah,
the psychic power can't resolve.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this is what is interesting, right? This is one of the reasons why this is so fascinating, because again, sometimes we think about the Buddha in the wrong way, yeah. And we are used to hearing about the Buddha, all the later stories where the Buddha has so many powers, and we think that the Buddha can resolve anything. It's like the Buddha is greater than the world. But actually, the Buddha is just a human being, yeah. And there's a limit to what a human being can do. And we will see this in a second when the Buddha actually does go to those monks, and he is not able to really resolve that issue. I think there's probably many things going on there, but one thing I think is that sometimes you just have to allow people to resolve things themselves. You cannot really always interfere in everything because people never learn. It's like if you have kids, then sometimes you just have to allow the kids to make mistakes, and they have to learn from the mistakes. You can't always resolve everything for your kids. They never learn anything. Yeah. And this is one reason, I think, why this is this way, because the Buddha, basically, he wants to allow the monastics to resolve. But another thing is just that the Buddha has limited powers, like everyone else. He's not like a universal kind of force, anything like that. He's a human being, yeah. And there's a limit to even what the Buddha can do. If you were in the presence of the Buddha, if the Buddha was here, you would probably be surprised. You would see the Buddha, as a human being. You wouldn't kind of be awed in the way you are. The reason we are so awed by the Buddha is because of all the history and all the extra layers of things that came afterwards. But actually, in reality, he comes across as human, just like anyone else when you meet him. So there's, I think, the limits of the Buddha are far greater than what we think they are usually. Yeah.
Ajahn, good morning.
Good morning, yes.
Okay. This is a very interesting sutta, actually, because I'm just having a bit of an argument, actually.
Okay. Are you wounding each other with the swords of the mouth, or are you...
No, we haven't got to that stage yet. But, actually, I'm quite curious about the outcome of this, but the issue that we were discussing was about attachment.
Attachment, yeah.
And at which point how do you let go of the attachment? Because for me, I feel that you have to accept the attachment,
yeah,
but then you slowly let it fade away. My friend over here has a different view because he says one of the suttas says otherwise. Maybe you want to add that.
Okay. It's about abhi nandati, abhi vadati, ajosayo titati. The process is when we have certain delight in something,
yeah,
we don't talk about it, we don't remain holding.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Sure. So I would... I think you're both right. So this is my because the truth is that ideally, we shouldn't hold on to these things. That's true, we shouldn't. But sometimes we have no choice, and it's actually very hard to let go. So sometimes we have to have a long-term strategy to learn to let go. In the meantime, we actually it's because we have a sense of self, actually, it's sometimes very difficult to let go. So we try. If we can let go, good. If we can't, then we have to carry on. And very much of the process of the whole Buddhist path is actually a process of developing even those things that are kind of ultimately defilements, like craving and attachment and the conceit I am, because they are part and parcel of who we are as human beings. We sometimes we have to, instead of letting go of them all at once. We have to let go of them gradually. So we let go of the more coarser defilements first of all, and we move to a higher level. We get rid of the more bad craving, and we have a lighter kind of craving. Let go of the bad attachment, go to a higher attachment. Let go of the bad conceit, go to more refined conceit. And from that more refined state, we can then let go more completely. Huh? So this is the same thing with views. Yeah, you have a view about something here, and maybe you are attached to that. Maybe you're attached to the idea of rebirth. Okay, it's okay to be attached to rebirth. It's kind of a stepping stone to move forward. But then you try to be aware of your attachment. And it's kind of interesting, when you are aware of your attachment, then you also become more careful with how you argue with other people about it. Yeah, because, you know, I'm attached here. It means that I can very easily fall into an argument with others. Because if others challenge my attachment, it's going to feel bad for me. And so you get into an argument easily. So by being aware of your own attachment, you can stop yourself before you get into arguments with others. And I think this is what is happening here with these monks. They are obviously attached to small rules in the Vinaya and taking this far too seriously and not really dealing with it in the right way. So that is the issue. So I think I would say you're both right. It's just different angles on the same thing. And the world is often like that. Very often we end up arguing with each other, and the reason we argue is not always that we disagree. It's just that we haven't really listened properly to the other person and tried to understand where we're coming from. When you start listening to other people properly, you realize they have part of the truth. You have part of the truth. And sometimes when you join forces, you see more of what's going on. Yeah, it's the famous story of the elephant. Yeah, the blind man and the elephant. Yeah, you know that story, of course. Anyone does not know the story of the blind man and the elephant? Okay, there's a few at the back there. Wow. Okay. Story of the blind man, very briefly, right? So there is an elephant, and there is seven blind men, and these blind men, they each one get to feel one part of the elephant, and then they have to tell someone else what that is, the thing that they're feeling, So one blind person feels the leg, and the elephant is a post, And one gets to kind of feel the ear, The elephant is like a fly whisk, Kind of flying, whisking away the flies. And one gets to feel the trunk, The elephant is like a hose, like a fire hose or something like that. And one gets to feel the body, the elephant is like a solid, large mass of rock. I can't remember exactly what it is. So each blind man has a different idea, of what the elephant is, because they feel a different part of the body. And then afterwards, they get these blind men together to discuss what the elephant is, and because they all felt a different part of the body, they argue with each other and quarrel. No, the elephant is this. No, you idiot. It's like this. You imbecile. It's like this. And then they get into a big fight because of that. But if they had got together and they had actually each one of them seen their side of the story, actually they would have been able to describe the elephant quite well. And life is often like that. Everyone has a partial truth, and when we understand our own partial understanding of reality, then actually we can listen to others in a new way, and we can maybe learn something from others, because they will have a different angle on these things. That's that story of the, which is actually a very nice story, and kind of one of the beautiful Buddhist stories. Anyway. Yeah.
To people that are learning about Buddhism, some people, study this and they say, well, this is the core Buddhism. Some, like maybe Abhidhamma, Sutta, whatever. And it's another comparison, isn't it? In Thai we have.
Yeah.
like the blind man passed the elephant and explain how that the elephant looks like. It's like people that study learning about Buddhism and whatever part of they think is important, and that is Buddhism.
Absolutely. I think that's true, but I think it can be applied very, very broadly to whenever we disagree about anything. But of course, when it comes to the Buddhist teaching, it's probably the most important, some of the most important parts. We don't argue too much about the Buddhist teaching.
No, my point is, in Thai, we have that story.
Yeah.
Maybe
the end is the truth.
No, everyone has. This is from the Udana, right? It's one of the core teachings in the suttas. So we all have that story. Yeah. All right. So let's carry on.